guardian.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I meet one of my unashamedly favourite directors in world cinema, Tran Anh Hung, the Vietnamese-born director who now brings his uniquely impressionistic style to the student unrest of late 60s Japan in adapting Haruki Murakami's novel Norwegian Wood. In the week of International Women's Day, we look at the position of women in film with guests from the ongoing Bird's Eye View Film Festival here in London. And Zan Brooks will be in to join me in skewering the week's other film releases, including Hall Pass, Fair Game, and The Company Men. I once had a girl, isn't it good? Yes, of course it is, it's Film Weekly. That's a quote from the lyrics of Norwegian Wood, you see. Born in Vietnam but moving to Paris at the age of 12 in 1975, Tran Anh Hung has been at the forefront of a modern wave of artistic Asian cinema. His debut, The Scent of Green Papaya, was Oscar-nominated in 1993. His follow-up, Cyclo, won the Golden Lion at Venice. And At the Height of Summer, in 2000, earned swooning plaudits and trendy audiences. His latest film, Norwegian Wood, is based on the 1987 book by Japan's Haruki Murakami and sees Hung working outside Vietnam for the first time. It's a powerfully beautiful story of love and loss, as our protagonist, Watanabe, looks back to 1969, when revolution was in the Tokyo air and when, haunted by the suicide of a good friend, he was torn between two beautiful women, an emotionally fragile childhood friend, Naoko, and a vivacious fellow student, Midori. Apart from the gripping narrative, there's a story around the film too. After hearing the soundtrack to There Will Be Blood in 2007, Tran Anh Hung persuaded its creator, Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood, to pen the score to his new film. I met up with Hung to find out how he collaborated with the reclusive Murakami, the busy Johnny Greenwood, and the ace cinematographer Mark Lee, whose previous images have included working with that other titan of Asian art house, Wong Kar-wai. I began by asking him why, since that wonderful 1993 debut, he's only made four films since.
I would like to make one movie per year, but the problem is so difficult to finance my movies. So that's why, you know, I have to wait 5-8 years to make a movie.
Oh, well, why do you think your films are particularly hard to get money for?
I think that it's because it's not a comedy, it's not an action movie. I don't know.
Not enough car chases.
Yes, not enough. Yes,
because it's a beautiful film, Norwegian Wood, and I say that because it's about beauty and about the loss of beauty or hanging on to beauty, the beauty of memory, the beauty of love. In a way, it's about quite a lot of things, Norwegian Wood.
Yes, it's quite. It's about, I think, first love, and especially when you lost this first love as soon as you encounter it. And Watanabe, he kind of suspended his life because he couldn't understand why Naoko, his first love, disappeared like this just after the night that they spent together. It's a movie about the fear of losing someone you love.
There's also, obviously, the source novel is something that you had to work with. Were you keen to kind of be faithful to the novel or to use it just as a start point and take off and explore the themes that are regularly in your work from it?
No, I think that I wanted to be faithful to my emotions when I read the book. It's very important because when you adapt a book, you're not only adapting the story, but also all the feelings that you had while reading the book. When the movie was finished, I showed it to Murakami, and he loved the movie. It was a pleasure for me because it's important that he recognize his old work, and I was happy.
Did he have input before you'd made it? Yes, you showed it to him when you had finished it, but did you show him the script before you began?
Yes, I showed him the first draft, and he gave me a lot of notes.
Did he?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, a lot. And it was my turn to give him notes about his notes. And that was it. After that, he gave me the green light.
One of the things I always enjoy about your work is the mix of music that you always put in. Obviously, in At the Height of Summer, you had Arab Strap, you had Lou Reed, Velvet Underground. Very beautiful music that you wouldn't necessarily expect in the setting where you are. There we are in downtown Hanoi in the morning, and we're listening to the underground instead of what you would say traditional Vietnamese music. And here again in the Norwegian Wood, we have a mix of Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead doing a very strange and interesting score, which is kind of like Western classical music, plus a little bit of, you know, the Beatles thrown in there as well, and a bit of German electronica from Cannes as well. How comes you kind of pick a setting and kind of then throw a music that's totally alien to it from it?
Oh, it's not alien. For me, it fits, perfectly, and it melts into the body of the movie, because I always want to make a movie that has the musical quality. I mean, that has the flow of the music. Mm. And I like what Johnny did for There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
Because it's a very deep music, sometimes very serious, and I like.
Did you work with Johnny Greenwood then? I mean, obviously you said to him, well, I like your score for There Will Be Blood. That meant many people liked his score for There Will Be Blood. Many people must have been asking him to write his next score. How did you convince him to do it, and then how did you work with him to show him what sort of images you would be using and the feel of your piece?
Oh, I met with him before I start shooting the movie. He accepted to do it, but then later on, I think something like 2 months later, he gave up on this idea because Tom York wanted to go back to, you know, to the recording session.
Do a day job.
Yes, so Johnny said that he was sorry. He need now to go back to where he belonged, meaning the band. Mm-hmm. So I was very sad. But then I shot the movie and then start editing the cut. And when I have scenes, then I try his music. I tried to put There Will Be Blood, the music that he composed. And it works so well. Then I sent him an email. I said, Johnny, I need you. Please, I will send to you some scenes with your music from There Will Be Blood. He said, Hung, are you crazy? This is Irish music. How can an Irish music fit, you know, a Japanese movie? But when he saw it, he said, okay, if you give up on the big orchestra and stick with a sextet, then maybe I will have time to do the score for you. And later on, when he start working on it, and then he go back to the orchestra.
So you have to thank Tom York as well for giving him some evenings off to make your music. It is an extraordinary piece of work when you add that. Plus, there's another artist that you work with on there, Mark Lee, a cinematographer people will know from his work with Wong Kar-wai, Chris Doyle. He does beautiful work. It seems to me very important in your film, the crispness of the images. I think it was in HD, am I right?
Yes, we shot in HD, yes. Mark was not really happy with it because he loved films. But for me, since today, everyone has a digital camera, and when you take a picture of your family or your friends, you have this texture of digital. So it become a new reality for me, and film has this nostalgic, you know, a feeling that today. So I didn't want to shoot with film anymore. But when I start to work with digital, I realize that what I was looking for from the beginning is how to show the skin in a very physical way, in a very concrete way, and digital can give it to me. So for me, it's the skin is more real than in film. Mm-hmm.
You really like the skin. The skin was what was important to you, because it's quite a physical film. I suppose it's about sex, isn't it, really? We don't see so much sex, but it is about sex.
Yes, exactly. And cinema is the art of incarnation. It's important to show the flesh, you know. It's important to be very precise on the skin.
There's one scene that I really must talk about, which I think is all of these things, the music, the naturalist colour, the kind of use of the skin, is one scene that I think it's, I don't know how long the shot is, but it seems to be one unbroken shot when Watanabe and Naoko go into the hillside and there's all the grass. They have this long argument. They discuss the past, and she tells him why she never had sex with Kizuki before. And they have this long shot, and you follow them. You follow them through the grass, almost like a wildlife for documentary. And the wind blows, and there's rain, and it's just beautiful. It is all one shot, isn't it?
Yes, it's one shot, and you can only do this with very good actors, because they would take care of everything. They would take care of the rhythm. You know, it's something that is impossible to direct. When you say action, then you know everything is rely on them, and so you can only do this with very good actors. I wanted the audience to have a very physical feeling of the scene. That's why I had them walking very fast in the grass, in the mud. And because when you walk fast, you change your breathing, and the words you are saying comes to the audience with an effort, and it gives you really a tense feeling of the scene, mm-hmm. And physical. That's why I wanted to do it in one shot. No manipulations, mm-hmm. You know, no cheating. No. It's just like this.
How long is it? Do we know?
I think it's more than 4 minutes.
Yeah, it feels like longer. I was breathless myself through it. When would it break? When would it stop? And there's a moment where I thought it would cut, and it doesn't. It continues, and she goes off wandering into the distance, and you still see her through the grass. It's a remarkable piece. Where is that shot? The grass is just so green and beautiful.
Yes, we spend a lot of time to find the right location, because I always want the landscape to echo the feelings of the character. This place was close to Kyoto. Yes, it's not far from Kyoto. Yes, and this harmony that you said, sometimes it's very strange, because for one scene, with Watanabe and Naoko, we have a very strong wind. And she was asking him if he would like a hand job. Mm. And it's a very cute scene, very, you know, very, really cute, very, very soft and tender, very tender. In fact, why during the shooting they have a helicopter above their head, mm-hmm. and I was the guy who asked the helicopter to go higher to have less wind, you know, according to the dialogue, and to go lower to have a bigger wind, and it was they couldn't hear themselves. I couldn't hear what they are saying. Yeah. You know, just watch their lips and guess where the, yeah. you know.
Yeah. Congratulations. I think you're the first person that said hand job on my show before, so that's very, very good. Congratulations on that. I noticed you got the Beatles in there twice. You got Norwegian Wood in the final credits. Was that difficult to get a Beatles track cleared?
Yes, I think so. But it was not my job. It was the producer part. And we didn't plan to have this song in the movie, because at the beginning we thought that it would be impossible to have it. Or too expensive. And then we thought that Johnny could do an instrumental of the song. But for one of the cut during the editing process, I put very intuitively, I put the music there at the end of the movie. And the producer loved it so much that he showed it to the financiers, and they love it, so that they put all the effort to have it.
Right. Beautiful film, and congratulations, Tran and Hung. Thank you very much to see you.
Thank you very much.
That Naoko wa boku no koto o aishite sai nakatta kara.
Ne, Watanabe-kun. Watashi ga ima nani shitagatteru ka wakaru?
で誰かに会ってるの？その時は私に話してね。
好きな人いる？
And Norwegian Wood is out on Friday, the 11th of March. She told me she worked in the morning and started to laugh. I told her I didn't and crawled off to sleep in the bath, which is exactly where I found our critic, Zan Brooks.
Hello, very good. That's so Alan Partridge, isn't it?
A new intro to you every week. Ha ha! You do look like you slept in a bath today, actually. You look actually kind of quite shevelled.
That's a step up from my usual yeah, gutter.
Exactly. I do think our first port of call does have to be Norwegian Wood, Zan, but we will also look at Hall Pass, Fair Game. I was going to call it Hair Game, combining those two. Hall Pass, Fair Game. I'll tell you about The Company Men, and you can tell me about Legacy Black Ops.
Okay, let's do that.
As well. But let's start with Norwegian Wood, having just heard from Tran Anh Hung there. I'm an enormous fan of Tran Anh Hung. It's always a pleasure to get someone who was an enormous fan on. It can be a problem, though, if you don't like their latest film. I actually really did like Norwegian Wood, but I know that when it played at Venice, there were very few people that were very sort of swooning over it.
I liked it as well, and I think it's a film that you need to swoon over, because the characters spend most of their time swooning. Mm. There's a lot of swooning in this. There's sort of over 2 hours of of kind of loaded looks and letters going back and forth and sort of slightly oblique conversations.
Austen, you know what I mean?
There is. This probably doesn't quite have the crispness of Jane Austen. Mm. It's very much luxuriating in the sights and sounds of late 60s Tokyo, and there's lots of sort of scenes in the rushes as they walk back and forth, and then wintry landscapes and college dorms. I don't remember much of that in Pride and Prejudice. But I did like it a lot. It's a film of mood and atmosphere as much as anything else. And I think maybe that kind of irritates people a bit.
It does, because, I mean, the narrative gets a bit, you're like, well, what's happening now? Suddenly he's living by the sea and I don't know what's going on. But, I mean, I sort of... But it earns the right to tell its tale that way, as far as I'm concerned.
I guess so. It reminded me of two other sort of Asian love stories. You know, obviously In the Mood for Love, the Wong Kar-wai one, and Liu Ye's Summer Palace, that I don't actually think got a proper release over here, but should have done,
really,
which was great.
It. Well, he got banned from showing it in Cannes, didn't he?
He did, yeah, because it was all set against Tiananmen Square and everything, even though it was a story of sexual awakening, which I guess this is as well. It's certainly sensual. There's a lot of sex scenes in there.
Aren't there?
But it's more about the trials of young love.
It's just, it's kind of tortured, isn't it? It's a little bit Smith's in its kind of posing. But I mean I like the costume, I like the texture, I really like the way it kind of, it was about memory, really. The book is about memory, the film is about memory, so it can be impressionistic, because I think that's how memories come back to us. So
I think and it's so beautiful to look at. It's almost like, it's very kind of cool and formal and precise in terms of what it's doing. But it's almost like a sort of beautiful ice cream sundae that's sort of gradually melting, and you're kind of watching it melt, and occasionally you get a little taste of it. It's not a film that you throw yourself in. It very much almost keeps you at a slight distance.
Yeah.
But for that, it's good.
I mean, his previous films did that as well. I mean, At the Height of Summer was just loads of kind of, you know, pretty women in Hanoi doing yoga for half of it.
Centre Green Papaya.
Yeah, same. I mean, and Cyclo as well. I mean, I just think he's a terrific artist. It was interesting you mentioned Wong Kar-wai, because it's shot by Mark Lee, who worked with Chris Doyle on the Wong Kar-wai films. Is it remiss of us to kind of group it into Asian art house, or... I mean, is that because you mentioned Liu Ye's Summer Palace? Are we just saying, well, they're all kind of like that? But there is a certain tone that that is a way of telling that is not kind of akin to anything we have here in Europe.
I think you have to group it in with that. And you're right, it's a different kind of narrative. It's a thing of mystery. And like human relationships are mysteries, even to the people who are in them. And so you've got the main character, Watanabe, who's sort of torn between two basically kind of capricious, supposedly unreliable girls. And you're not sure which way he's going to go. And he's not sure. And that's how it kind of plays out, basically. And, you know, who's to say? That's probably more truthful than, you know, a Jennifer Aniston rom-com, dare I say it.
Slightly. I mean, that's the one problem with Tran Anh Hung's work. There's not enough Jennifer Aniston, as well as Carl.
You know, if this does well, maybe you'll get Jennifer for the next one.
That's Norwegian Wood. We're going to go to a completely different world now, Zan. Hall Pass, the latest film from the Farrelly brothers. They have Dumb and Dumber, and There's Something About Mary. Here, Owen Wilson stars as a husband who's given a pink ticket. He's given a week off from marriage to go and behave as he would if he was single.
But I don't know how you could be so calm, knowing that our husbands are out there chasing tail all over town.
Shh, keep it down. Relax. Here's how I see it. Rick and Fred are like a couple of domesticated cats scratching at the door. And then the first time you let them out, they are so paralyzed with fear, they turn around and bolt right back into the house.
Yeah, okay, but we're not talking about cats here. We are talking about dogs.
What choice do we have?
I don't know. I mean, why couldn't we just keep the status quo? Were things really that bad that we have to do something this extreme?
For me, they were. Remember last week when we went to Lucy's award thing?
Yeah.
Well, that night, Rick and I were gonna, you know.
Yeah, right.
And I started wondering, who is he gonna be thinking about when we're having sex? So when he came into the room...
What?
I pretended to be asleep.
You're kidding. You've never done that before? Oh, God, I do that all the time.
Really?
Yes. I think it's our job as women that between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., we just fake everything.
Zan. The Farrelly brothers, back on form. I have to say that I've never thought they were ever anywhere near any sort of form ever.
Oh, really? I see. I disagree with you on that. I think There's Something About Mary is one of the great American comedies of the last
Really? I was on the
years.
Poster for that when it came out.
And were you? Which one were you?
It said at the
you
bottom...
You weren't Mary.
No, it said at the bottom... I was the dog, I think, being kicked in the air. Because I said at the bottom, I just don't get it. And it's my favourite ever poster quote from
me. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And what, they put it on there after what loads of swooning. Because everyone went mad, didn't they, at the time? Oh, the new Rabelais has arrived, the new Swift. Yeah. What a lot of shit. I loved it,
and I think you're at fault for not getting it. But if you don't get this, I'm with you in the not getting. this is bad, and this proves my theory that, you know, comedy directors maybe have a couple of films in them and then it's over, yeah, and it's played.
You can be funny, and I can admit that there's a sort of new humour that they brought to this something about it. But if you can't direct, then you just become plot. I mean, it's just like, point the camera, shoot, you come in, stop. I mean, the direction is just abysmal. They've got worse as filmmakers.
They have, and also, you know, another person that I like a lot is Owen Wilson.
Yeah, the butterscotch stallion. That's why you like him.
And I have no idea what he's doing in this. He's all wrong for the
Isn't
part of the sort of middle-aged lech who gets the hall pass to sort of indulge his fancies.
I think they suddenly thought, well, actually everyone is so reprehensible in this. All the men are just disgusting. I'm a man. You're a man as well. I'm sure we have disgusting habits, but really,
what would you do with your hall pass then, Jason?
What would I do with my hall pass? Yeah. I'd probably go and watch football.
Would you?
Or go to the pub.
There's Nick Rogue season at the BFI South Bank.
I might go down to that. I might even go to a jazz concert, which I'm not allowed to do. But I wouldn't.
I wouldn't
go to Hooters, whatever it is. Or they don't even go to Hooters. They go to somewhere like, I don't know, some steakhouse, and they're so bloated and drunk. I mean, it made me shame to be human, not male, just human. I hated everyone in this.
Again, I've got no problem with scatological comedy and the lowest common denominator humour, but you've got to kind of care about the people and the situation a little bit. And this, there's nothing real.
Because you've got to worry that their marriage will be, oh, if he does kind of have sex with this kind of company. You know, I would say maybe I would go and watch female volleyball match. I'm not against
kind of
leching as well. But, you know, you would worry dramatically if my marriage was, you would like, no, he's got a good wife. He doesn't need to kind of
jeopardize. Yeah, don't go
watch
the girls play volleyball.
Yeah.
Go to Pizza Express instead.
Well, I would do? I would order Veneziana and with my 25p save Venice from sinking.
And just read the paper.
Yeah. Do something. Wouldn't it be nice? Put my feet up.
I think it might even make a more entertaining film than this as well.
Did you know what? It was awful, wasn't
it? It was really bad, wasn't it?
It was just all wrong. It's really
bad. Bad film.
Okay, shall we pass?
Let's pass.
We'll go on to Fair Game, a film that debuted at Cannes last year. It's the true story, allegedly, of Valerie Plame, a CIA agent who was outed by the press and had to give up the game.
What's that?
That's the Senate Select Committee intelligence report. On page 39, it says the former ambassador's wife offered up his name. It then includes a memorandum written by Valerie Plame, which says, quote, my husband has good relations with both the prime minister and the former minister of mines, both of whom could shed light on this sort of activity. This is exactly what I've been denying.
No.
Every newspaper, every television, radio, anybody that would listen to me, saying my wife did not send me on a junket.
I didn't send you.
You
I didn't
sent
have that
an
power.
Email. The SSCI found the email. Why didn't
emails.
You tell me? It never occurred to you in all this time that this would be important?
I didn't make the decision. I was asked to write a recommendation. What was I supposed to do? Not say my husband knows about this?
Well, they have this now. They'll call me a liar and it'll stick. Because they have all the power. What do I have? My word. You've got to speak up, Valerie. You've got to go on the record now. You've got to defend us now.
Played by Naomi Watts. Her husband is Sean Penn, Zan. Is this Fair Game?
It was seen as Fair Game by the Bush administration, which famously unmasked CIA agent Valerie Plame as a way of getting back her husband Joseph Wilson, who was a former US ambassador, who basically blew the whistle in the run-up to the war in Iraq by saying that there's no way that Saddam Hussein was getting uranium from Niger, which was one of the main planks of Bush's argument. So it was a big story, and it's a fascinating story in its way of diplomatic etiquette and something that maybe shows how the Bush administration was as much at war with America and American institutions as it was with the regimes it was supposed
and
to topple.
And American liberalism.
And American liberalism. But even that's kind of complicated because she's a CIA agent. Joseph Wilson was a sort of, you know, a pillar of the establishment. So these aren't these kind of reds in the bed dissidents at all we're dealing with here, which makes the story a bit more complicated, and it needs teasing out and framing better than it is here.
Yeah, it's directed by Doug Liman, who gave us the first Bourne film, gave us Swingers as well.
Swingers and Go.
And Go. Neither of which point to a man who can delicately unpick the political fronds of the tapestry that you so describe.
No, not at all. This basically leans very hard on all the usual ingredients of the political drama. There's lots of sort of military percussion and swooping shots over Washington, D.C., and it ends with a God bless America. It's the worst kind of conservative liberalism, this film. And I just didn't give a damn about these people.
I mean, I hated it. I hated Sean Penn and his polo neck and his glasses, kind of always kind of looking, putting down his paper with his little glass of bourbon and just kind of going and being all kind of polo necky. And, Naomi Watts, who I really respect as an actress, I just thought she was almost underused, which is a bit weird given that she's the lead in this film.
Yeah.
All she gets to do is sort of stay at home and do some cooking. And washing up.
Well, there's this weird sort of thing that it becomes a sort of domestic soap opera about their marriage, which I guess could be interesting, but it isn't here.
Right, if he'd have had a hall pass, it'd be interesting.
Exactly. You've got to look at it in the broader context. This is a story about life and death and a war crime, basically. There are hundreds of thousands of people dying. I don't care that a CIA agent gets kind of shouted at in a fancy restaurant in Washington. Yeah. And you're meant to care about that. You're thinking, this is the real tragedy here. It wasn't.
This is exactly, I'm completely wrong-headed from the start. I hated Fair Game, I must say. I'm glad I'm hating things this week.
We really are, aren't we?
Yes. Shall I tell you about The Company Men?
Do.
Because it's got a great cast. Chris Cooper.
Yeah.
Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
Maria Bello.
This is getting better and better.
Sounds great, doesn't it?
But.
But it's not very good.
Right.
John Wells is the director.
This is you in hate mode again.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was boring. It's what it's about. It's about a company in America who's caught in a recession, have to lay off their men. It's a big billionaire company, sort of top Forbes list thing, whatever they have. They all see Fortune 500, CEOs, all of that stuff. There's a lot of that around at the moment after Inside Job, the documentary, and the Elliot Spitzer film, Client 9. So this is about, a real kind of what happens to white collar workers when they're sort of, they can't pay for their kids' education at Brown, and they kind of the real impact. I mean,
there's a Jeopardy problem here, isn't there?
I'm not that concerned. You're Ben Affleck. You're married to Rosemary, did it? You've overextended your mortgage a bit.
Yeah.
Sell
up and move to a million-dollar house.
He turns down a house. He turns down a job in somewhere nice, Little Rock, Arkansas or something, because I can't do that because I'm from Boston.
Yeah.
So, it's like, you've got another job. Just go and get it. Stop moaning. It was a film of unending miserable moaning by people who really should know better. Legacy Black Ops, which you're going to tell me about.
Legacy Black Ops, I'm sure they were hoping for big Oscars for Legacy Black Ops. Tragically, it didn't happen.
You've left out the colon.
Legacy colon Black Ops, brilliant. Just to give it that extra heft. And this is a film about legacy. It stars Idris Elba.
Big Idris.
Idris is great, and I'm hoping at some point we can talk about Idris Elba without saying Idris Elba from The Wire, who played Stringer Bell in The Wire.
Well, apparently he gets very annoyed if you do say
I've heard that, but, he's only got himself to blame.
It's for being in The Wire.
For being in Legacy Black Ops after The Wire, and also that film that he did with Beyonce a while ago as well.
Oh, that was poor.
That was bad. He's good in this. The film itself isn't so great. He's basically a former Black Ops soldier. Whose team were gunned down with extreme prejudice. He's now in a sort of flop house out in Brooklyn and trying to work out why it happened and who ordered it. And it's something that leads him rather close to
Cap, home. What the fuck's going on?
Aguera, get onto the radio and let Control know that we miss Selenko. Those readings completely clear?
On a goddamn trace.
I got a bad feeling about this.
Yeah, well, you got a bad feeling about everything.
Only two guys with pea shooters, now a fucking empty room.
What's the deal with Control?
Line's dead.
You worried now?
Keith, take a look around, see if there's any signs that Terran or Selenko were here.
Our intel is never this off. We need to get our asses out of here.
I give you an order.
And so there he is. It's very claustrophobic, this film, because it's basically set in this flat in Brooklyn, and he tries to get a journalist to kind of find his brother. I was a bit like, well, I don't really care.
Well, okay. This is the motif that's running through this show. Do we care? It's a weird film, this. The title Legacy Black Ops and the opening scene leads you to expect a kind of combat-fueled shoot-em-up movie.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's a sort of... it's like a one-act play that dreamed of being a shoot-em-up movie.
Yeah, it's very cheap, obviously.
It's very cheap.
There's low budget and there's cheap, and I thought this was cheap.
This looked a bit cheap and tatty.
Because you can be violent, and I don't mind violent, but it also had to kind of... There was a lot of acting going on. It was a lot of Idris Elba kind of going, look, I'm really cool, I'm a really good actor, look, I'm enormous,
yeah.
Really good.
And he's basically, he's almost like a kind of, is he really onto something, or is he just losing his marbles and becoming a bit of a sort of Travis Bickle type?
Yeah.
Hold up and sort of seeing shadows everywhere. There's a good film to be made of that, but this is too leaden and laborious a setup to honour that.
There's a nice performance from Clark Peters, who's an actor I really admire. I'm watching him in Tremé at the moment.
Yes, exactly.
And he's really good. He's really nice. He's like his sort of buddy.
Yeah.
One of the, and he's got the whole weight of the world. I love. I think he's a really
fine
actor.
Brilliant. He's brilliant. There's some good stuff in here, but it is a bit tatty and one note.
That's Legacy Black Ops. Thank you very much, Zan. Lovely to see you. Go back to sleep in the bath. For more of Zan's searing cinematic opining, go to guardian.co.uk/film. The Bird's Eye View Festival kicks off its 9th edition in London this week, celebrating women in film. It's set to showcase short films by the world's most exciting emerging women filmmakers, including award winners and Oscar shortlisteds, and a look at women in gothic and horror, as well as documentary slots. I'm joined by Rachel Millward, who co-founded the festival back in 2002, motivated by the stat that only 7% of filmmakers are women. She's also joined by a very small percentage of that small percentage in Zeina Dura, who has a film at this year's festival called The Imperialists Are Still Alive. Welcome to the Film Weekly studio, both of you. That stat, which I remember being part of that first film festival, you kindly asked me to along, it was shocking. It was the first time that stat had really been kind of bandied about, and everyone went, 7%, that's just nothing. Has that improved any?
Not really is the very sad answer. People are more used to hearing it, though, now. But I think, you know, Catherine Bigelow winning the Oscar last year got lots of attention on this issue. But in Hollywood, there's a report just came out recently by Martha Lauzon, who actually suggests that the statistics in Hollywood are kind of going down a bit in feature films. So it's more like 6% for directors and 10% of writers. So that's a bit depressing. In the UK, we had the best year we've had in the UK, I think, was 2009, when of all the films produced in the UK, about 15% were directed by women. So that was a peak, but let's face it, it ain't brilliant.
Your festival carries on, though. I mean, it's hard to fund festivals in general. Any festival is finding it hard. So you're obviously finding something that is attracting people and sponsors and enables your festival to continue.
Well, I think we get support because the cause is really important, and because people in the industry, once you say that statistic, people are shocked, and people who work in the industry really want to see change. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of women out there and men who just are fed up of not having a balanced perspective and a balanced workplace, and kind of just want that. The creativity that comes really from diversity and allowing different people's perspectives.
Which areas is it specifically? Is it directing that you'd like to see more? Is it crew you'd like to see more? Executives, well, script writers?
I mean, we'd like to see more of everything, but what the festival focuses on specifically is directors, and often it's writer-directors and directors and writers, those kind of teams. I guess what we're interested in is the story and the controlling of the images, and it's the creative vision of women that we're celebrating, really. So you do tend to get somewhere between 20 and 30% of producers are women. So that's still not high, but it's a lot higher. And there's a lot of chat about, is that because women are very good at nurturing someone else's creative vision or that thing, rather than risking their own in that kind of way?
Zeina Dura is looking at you like, oh my god, that's a kind of disgusting, kind of almost motherly stereotyping there, Rachel. Is that right? Is that what you felt, Zeina?
I definitely do. At the same time, it is really important to have people there who understand a different perspective, because it's not necessarily about just being a woman. It's just very hard to get any script out there that isn't, and I hate to say it like this, but the white male view. Like, when I was trying to get my film made in New York, because I was out there for 10 years, because I went to NYU grad film and then I stayed on. And one of the first sort of things that came back through feedback was, well, you know, the guys in this movie are really underdeveloped, and it's actually they're not. It's just that it was about a woman, and the men in it are great, and they come off it. You'll see the film.
Do you feel like saying, well, have you ever seen most movies where women are completely
That's the point, you know. And, you know, there was no one in like a, you know, silk dressing gown smoking by a window, and so suddenly, like, the film had the men, you know, the men were underdeveloped in the film. So I think that it's really key in just many different ways that people people don't write off projects by minority voices or voices that haven't, you know, been able to make their films yet, because that's actually where a lot of the interesting stuff is.
Yeah, take us into the world of your film, The Imperialists Are Still Alive! Exclamation mark.
Exclamation mark is very important. It was a very difficult film to make because you had to really believe in me as a director, because it was kind of like, because it had never been seen before, everyone's like, what the hell is she on about? But it was really about how you live and digest conflict, because, you know, I'm British but originally Middle Eastern and Bosnian, so how you live in your daily life with this inherited conflict, but you're sort of very you're very immersed in the world that you are living in. You're not like this kind of estranged character that they love. And for me, what was really interesting is when I made my film, a lot of people were like, well, why don't you do it about, because the film was about a girl who is political, who's from a pretty left-wing family, and yet she comes from privileged background, and she has political concerns, but she's part of the whole downtown scene in New York, which is kind of glam, rock and roll, you know, high low,
back end Chinese.
Exactly. There you go. There you go. So they were like, well, that just can't exist, and you know, she should be not political and then become political, or she should be this way or that. And frankly, that's not my story. And there are many people like me who happen to be brought up in a world which might, you know, seem that it's in conflict with the world they're from, but it's not actually, because it's all about fusion and it's about how you grow up and the different things that you see. And that's really what my film was dealing with.
You know, I wouldn't be telling you this if you weren't the kind of girl that seemed to be in a quest. You have to try it. It's a spiritual experience.
What's the password?
I'm a friend of Mr. Tang's.
Got it, thanks.
My brother lives in Beirut, so I always go to Damascus when I visit him.
Rachel, you've obviously given Zaina a London premiere and a big sort of stage.
Very excited
for
about it.
What sort of things do you look for? I mean, there are women's films, women's works, as we mentioned, documentaries, shorts, all of these things around. If I'm a woman, I should come to you and I'm going to get in your festival? I think you're a bit more selective than that, aren't you?
Oh, very, very picky. Very, very picky. We have some established names kind of who are great inspirational role models for everybody and obviously just brilliant entertainment. And then we also like to take some risks and show some debut features, and Zaina's is one of those, which I do just love the fact that it's like nothing you've seen in cinema before. Its tone is so fresh and it's funny as well.
I mean, it's got a very confrontational opening scene. I mean, anyone who goes to your film, I mean, yeah, I mentioned Eddie Buchanan fur coat and it's all kind of nice nighttime New Yorky thing, but the opening scene is very strong.
Full
She's
on.
There in a kaffir scarf, naked. Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of her work as a conceptual artist, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, it's part of your work as a conceptual artist as well. That is what you're confronted with. I mean, as a bird's eye view, as a bird's eye view festival, that is kind of like, whoa.
That's the image.
You don't be seeing that very often. What do you hope for the festival going forward? I mean, in a way, people have said, do a bird's eye view, that doesn't that ghettoize it slightly? That makes it women filmmakers. I always would say, they're just films, you know, they're just films. They're not by women, they are by...
Well, I think that what we have achieved, really, I mean, you're saying when we first came out and said, look, 7% of films are directed by women, and we said that in the press and to the industry, everyone was like, no way. They hadn't actually had that statistic on the radar. So it's really important, I think, to kind of keep the spotlight on this until we have a balance. So what we, as long as we're showing a total range of films, as long as we're not saying women all make, you know, weepy dramas or women all make this kind of movie, as long as we're saying women can make all these films and look how amazing these women are, so there's kind of no excuse for that statistic.
I think you're almost quite self-conscious in the fact that there are no rom-coms. There's no 27 Dresses in here. I don't know if that's because you just got
that. Well, the newest you've got to rom-com is a documentary, actually. Guilty Pleasures, this documentary about the Mills and Boone phenomenon, is itself a kind of rom-com. It follows these amazing narratives. It's quite unlike a normal documentary. It's not issue-y. Mm. It's actually funny and lovely.
I'm not saying you need a rom-com, but people would be looking. You know, there's no what you would call chick flicks. That you're quite far from chick flicks.
Yeah, I mean, it's not... I think if we had... It's obviously partly due to the fact these are mainly indie films. You know, they're from the high profile to the kind of new filmmakers, they're in that, they come in the indie territory, don't they? So that's part of it.
But isn't it, we need the mainstream to be...
Yeah, we need it all, don't we?
I was going to say infiltrated by women. I don't know if that's right, but we need the mainstream to be... That's where the representation needs to happen. I mean, it's kind of sort of at the bottom at the moment. If in the indie scene, would it be great if it came from the,
well, Susan,
right from the top?
I mean, you know, Suzanne Beer's not the bottom, Catherine Bigelow's not the bottom, Andrea Arnold's not the bottom, but they're maybe on the more kind of indie end. I mean, yeah, we want to see change everywhere, don't we? We you know, the festival can work on different levels.
And yeah, I think, absolutely. So going forward, that's what you would, you know, be great to see.
Yeah, yeah. Have a next Nora Ephron.
Studio film.
Absolutely,
Nora
Ephron's, why not?
Yes. The festival runs from March the 8th to the 17th. So if you're in London over the next week, check out birds-eye-view.co.uk for all the information you need about the programme. Meanwhile, thanks to the festival director, Rachel Millward, and director, Zeina Dura, for coming to Film Weekly. And that is nearly all for this week, save to say that we have a competition winner to reveal. Cast your mind back to our Oscar night special. In there, we threw in a little competition on voice recognition. We played you clips from a selection of Film Weekly guests over the last year, and you had to guess the voice. The answers were, of course, Mark Ruffalo, Ryan Gosling, Ethan Coen, Darren Aronofsky, and Mila Kunis. The first person to correctly identify them on our Facebook page, Film Weekly Fans, was Sara Hemrajani. Congratulations to you. You win a DVD of Oscar nominee Winter's Bone. That'll be in the post to you sharpish. Watch out for those squirrels, Sara. Thanks to everyone who took part. The music we featured in the podcast this week was, for the second time on Film Weekly, the score to Norwegian Wood, but it's composed by Johnny Greenwood and it's rather fantastic. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday. My trailer trash column will be there as ever, and the best film news and reviews. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Lucy Greenwell, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.